Coming up on the latest edition of Serie A Awesome. Serie A returns from the international break with the Derby della Madonnina, but sadly more positive COVID tests too, and that includes Cristiano Ronaldo. We'll be discussing this and more of the weekend's games on the show with Nikki Bandini, Mina Rizzucchi and Matteo Bonetti. Hello and welcome into Serie A Awesome. I'm Kay Murray and we will start with the news that Cristiano Ronaldo has tested positive for COVID-19. He left the Portuguese national team camp this week. He won't feature now in Juventus's meeting with Crotone this weekend, then the Dinamo Kiev game in the Champions League, but it's also looking very unlikely that he'll feature against Barca at the end of this month, which is also a game in the Champions League. And there's nothing, Mina, that Juventus can do about that, because this will fall under UEFA protocol.
Yeah, absolutely. So UEFA protocol dictates that a document must be sent in 7 days before a Champions League game to explain who out of the players has tested negative for COVID-19 and then becomes eligible to play the match. That leaves Ronaldo with a 1 week window to test negative, provide the documentation for Juventus to then forward on to UEFA to allow him to play against Barcelona. So 1 week to really recover from something is a lot of pressure. This isn't just an injury that he just can train better or harder, obviously. And when you consider the fact that players like Paulo Dybala took 46 days and they continue to test positive, I mean, a week really is cutting it thin. So it's highly unlikely he'll be unavailable for Barcelona. When you consider his performances and how important he is for a team that is still in the middle of experimentation, the fact that he was very much the saviour for Juventus against Roma, a team that, in all honesty, should have lost that match had it not been for Ronaldo, then it's a little bit worrying how they are going to cope without him and how Pirlo is going to try to find the right team going forward in order to win these games.
It's definitely right what Mina's saying there. He's so crucial to any team he's in, but we've seen how much Juventus do rely on him, not just his goals, but the drive that he brings to the rest of the team as well and what he demands of them, Matteo.
Yeah, absolutely. And just before we get into that, Kay, I think the most important thing is that he is symptomatic and that Giorgio Chiellini actually even said that he's fine and that he's been getting a lot of sun during his positive COVID test. So at least he seems to be in good spirits. And it's just crazy to think that a few weeks ago, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and now it's, I think, over 30 Serie A players, most of them Genoa players, have tested positive. And then you hear Cristiano Ronaldo, who's almost this mythical figure, maybe the most famous face in world football that everyone knows. And that really did make headlines across all news outlets, transcending sport. So the most important thing is that he gets better very quickly and that he's fine now and that hopefully didn't affect too many other people in the process. But looking at the Juventus angle, Juventus have relied on Cristiano Ronaldo to bail them out of a lot of matches, and they've really looked at him to be the leader up front, to be the one that when times are tough, that he can be the focal point in getting those goals. I mean, he went over 30 goals last season in Serie A, but it's also the symbolism that he provides, that you have this once-in-a-generation type player in your starting 11, someone that all the other players look up to, someone that was brought over to Juventus because of what he did in part in that Real Madrid game when he scored the overhead kick, and so many of his moments have been etched in history. So to lose him now against Barcelona, which seems to be the likely case based on what Mina just laid out, is really terrible, because the Messi versus Ronaldo, that's one of the greatest rivalries in football history, maybe since I've been born. That is the rivalry, right? Seeing those two go head-to-head and bringing the best out of each other, which is another big point, is that when they were in La Liga, they were pushing each other, striving for greatness, trying to beat each other for the Pichichi title, and it would have been one heck of a matchup to see them once again in such a meaningful game like the Champions League for different teams in different leagues.
It means Pirlo's got some thinking to do then, doesn't he, Mina? Because obviously if there's one player you know you can rely on and is always in your first 11, it's going to be Cristiano Ronaldo.
Although this does open up other avenues, which could be very interesting now. God forbid, I mean, I am a Juventus fan, and obviously I love Ronaldo being there because he's the man who absorbs the pressure. Obviously, he offers all the leadership skills. And like I said, against Roma, he was the guy that carried them through to secure the points when Adrian Rabiot was sent off. But I do think that this makes for a little bit more balance, perhaps, when Pirlo is struggling to find that. I'm going to be honest, I was very happy with Pirlo after the game against Sampdoria. And there was a part of me that was like, you know, calm down, this is just Sampdoria, so we don't know what's going forward. And then, of course, he put out that team against Roma. And I just looked at the starting lineup and I was terrified. And I am terrified of him now going forward. I am really scared that, you know, he talks about balance and he talks about all these, you know, wonderful things that you want to hear from an Italian coach. But my fear is that he is such an idealist in football and you know, he is a fan of a Pep Guardiola. And so my fear is that he might look down on certain things. He played so many vertical players against Roma, and it seems like he really loves this attacking lineup going forward. But if you have no balance, if you have no defensive structure, you're as good as dead. And if you don't have someone like Ronaldo who can carry you through, then this is really scary. But Chiesa, Kulusevski on the wings, Morata going forward. There isn't, you know, very many people attacking. I just want a defensive lineup that, personally speaking, doesn't include Danilo. I want a little bit more balance in midfield. That is the part that he is supposed to be, like, helping us. If he once again decides to set out a team that has about 15 vertical points and nobody who knows how to possess the ball or set the tempo, then I'm telling you, I'm begging for Allegri to take this position back.
Well, perhaps it's a bit of a blessing that the first game without Ronaldo is against Crotone, a team that's at the very bottom of the league. They've lost their first three games, no wins at all. But Matteo, you have seen what the predicted 11 is going to be. So tell us what that is, and then you two can get into it.
Yeah, and funnily enough, as Mina was saying, the lineup seemed to get more imbalanced, more offensive. Did you see the lineup that he put out against the game that never happened in Napoli? Mm. That was the most offensive lineup that we've seen so far. Maybe he did that because he knew that the game wasn't going ahead. But that the talk after match day two was about the unbalanced nature. No, of course, but it was a very unbalanced team. Why was Frabotta not in there? And you saw Cuadrado playing out of position. You're using Kulusevski as a right wing back, which works, but it kind of reminds me of the Bernardeschi situation at Fiore, where it's like, yeah, they can play there, but is that their best position? So the expected lineup.
And you have a wing that has Danilo and Kulusevski. Are you crazy? Where's the defensive
one whole wing?
So you're not going to be too happy, Mina, because in the expected lineup, Danilo is still there as one of the three center backs with Chiellini and Bonucci. So no real surprise there. Cuadrado's back at right wing back. So that's his normal position. That's where he's been playing through the last few years. I'm actually more excited about this midfield pairing of Arthur and Bentancur because I think that those are the two players that really know how to play the ball, that have a bit more guile and creativity. Frabotta's back at left wing back, the 50,000 euro man. And then the front three, this is the interesting part because Kulusevski's there at right winger. Federico Chiesa makes his debut for Juventus, supposedly at left wing. And then Morata leading the line. But I'm really curious to see Chiesa and Kulusevski, who can run so much. They're both very quick. They're dynamic. They're direct. They like to take on their defender, and they both love to cut inside. So without Cristiano Ronaldo, this team feels a bit quicker. Obviously, you're missing that focal point with the goals, with the aerial ability. But it's great to see Chiesa right in there in the mix just weeks after joining Juventus, starting in a trident in his best position, because there's been a lot of talk that he might play as a wingback, which, again, he can do. He's been doing it now the last few rounds at Fiorentina. But is that his best position? That's my biggest doubt.
You see, my fear with all of this is that I don't know whether he's going to start being really stubborn about this sort of three defenders at the back. I would like there to be as many midfielders as possible, frankly speaking. So I would play Bentancur and Arthur all the time. I agree with you because for one thing, at least they know how to possess the ball. They know how to take this thing out of the game. They know perhaps a little bit together how to set the tempo. Against Roma, you had two box-to-box midfielders and you overwhelmed them. So of course, Rabiot was going to sent off, going to get sent off. McKinney was subjected to lots of criticism. It is social media, so let's not read too much into it. But it's a little bit unfair to leave players like that overwhelmed in midfield and then have so many vertical points and attacking options going forward. So we do need players who know how to possess the ball. And I think it would be interesting to also have McKinney and perhaps just have three strong centre-backs, Demiral at this moment in time, because I really think this is the future of Juventus. I loved him even more than I loved De Ligt when he came into Juventus. Him, Bonucci and Chiellini would give me a solid back line, pack the midfield, have Weston McKinney, have Arthur and have Bentancur. And then you can try to get the width from the forwards. And then you can have McKinney and perhaps Bentancur drop into any spaces they can on the wings when they need to in defense, out of position and out of possession. But going forward, I think that possesses a lot more balance than some of the things that Pirlo is looking to do. My fear is that he's going to look down on the defensive side of the game, that he believes in this attacking philosophy, and he might always want to go forward, seeing like, oh, well, look at Lazio, they play with so many attacking points. Carlo Ancelotti played with four attacking midfielders for Real Madrid and went on a 23-match winning streak. But of course, he possessed four of the most intelligent midfielders in Kroos and Luka Modric and Isco and James Rodriguez. It's not the same for Juventus. They just don't have the midfield that can support them. So I hope he understands how to find this balance.
A quick update for Serie Awesome that has transpired since we finished recording the pod is that Weston McKennie of Juventus has tested positive for COVID-19. And it means that Juventus team have now entered into an isolation period themselves. So this is quite the news, Matteo. It's yet another player testing positive. It's Weston McKennie that we've been talking about a lot, and it's just not good news for Juventus or the league.
Yeah, and let's also look at the historical timeline. When you look at last summer and post-lockdown and how few cases there were all over Serie A, this also went hand in hand with the period that Italy was having, that they had largely contained COVID-19 a lot better than now, where we're seeing this new fall wave that was expected all over the world. In the US, we're seeing it all over Europe, with some of the countries that had problems in the spring now having problems now in the fall. And we're seeing spikes in Italy with COVID cases, the most that we've seen in months. And this has also gone hand in hand with then players falling ill with the general population. And Juventus now have another case in Weston McKennie to go along with Cristiano Ronaldo, who was apparently on a plane back to Turin, where he's going to do the rest of his quarantine. But this is not good news, Kay.
No, absolutely not. And then obviously, because of this, Juventus will now go into isolation themselves. So what does that mean for the weekend? What does that mean for them going forward and for the rest of the players who obviously will undergo the tests that they would anyway, right?
Yeah, well, if they're all in the same hotel, then I think they're going to carry out tests pretty regularly. Right now, I believe it was 48 hours before games, they were doing all the tests of the squad. And now they're going to see, are there any other infections? They're going to, I'm assuming, test them regularly up until this weekend to see who's fit to be on the team and who's testing negative and who has to enter a period of quarantine for nearly 2 weeks.
Yeah, so they're not allowed contact with people outside of this group, and they will, the club, be in constant contact with the health authorities in the region. As we've explained to you before, it's regionally based, which is why we heard the story that we did last week with Napoli. And there leads us to another piece of news that's actually happened since we finished recording today's pod. And it's the fact that the committee have voted on the outcome of Napoli not turning up for that game against Juventus last week. We were waiting to hear what would happen from it. And Matteo, the news is in.
The news is in, and it's not looking good for Napoli. The 3-0 forfeit loss, that's less surprising, but there is an added punishment, which is a -1 point deduction in the Serie A standings to go along with a forfeit loss. Now, this is fresh news. I just put it out on Twitter to gauge the general opinion. I wrote, how do you feel about this? And I said, is it scandalous, too harsh, just right, or too lenient? 42% say scandalous, 28% too harsh, 27% just right, and then 3% too lenient. I have a bit of a problem with this one, Kay, because I understand that you're enforcing the laws that were just created months ago for an unprecedented pandemic, for a time of uncertainty, laws that were put in place before this wave of COVID cases throughout Italy, where the situation has gotten a lot worse in most countries in the world that have been battling this pandemic since February. So I have a bit of a problem when you're being such a stickler for the rules for something that is so fresh and so new, and you're telling me you have no wiggle room for a situation that no one's ever been in. No one could have seen how this would play out for the rest of the season. And that's what's bugging me about this. I understand that you're setting a dangerous precedent if you're allowing the game to be rescheduled, because then suddenly teams that have had even more COVID cases, look at Genoa, that have to maybe play with their youth team because they've had so many senior players testing positive. Look at Inter, that have over 6 positive COVID tests now. Then they could look at Napoli and say, right, we don't want to play this weekend. The derby scrapped. Good luck finding a time to redo it given the congested football calendar. So I understand that side of it, that they're like, right, this is going to set a dangerous precedent. If local government get in the way, who is the ruling authority? Is it City Eye? Is it the local government? Well, clearly, they're not giving any breaks to Napoli. But the one-point deduction after a 3-0 forfeit, I'm sure Napoli are going to go to court about that. I'm sure they're going to appeal. And I would be shocked if they don't get that point back. I think that is ridiculous to add that along with a 3-0 forfeit. To me, it's overly harsh, and I expect to see something done about it. But I also understand where the league is coming from, where they're saying, listen, we can't just postpone games. We agreed that if you have 13 players that are fit and ready to go, you're playing the game. And clearly, they want the season to keep going, even if there are tests and many more tests, like what we're seeing with Inter. Is it the right decision? It's too soon to tell.
Well, thanks for that update, Matteo. What we will do now, though, is go back to the podcast that we did record earlier, where we talk about your interview with Weston McKennie himself. Well, you mentioned Weston McKennie. You know that he's now Matteo's best friend, right? After Matteo had a sit-down interview with him last week. But it was actually really interesting. I think what really stood out for me, and maybe you would expect it, but it was the humility that he showed in that interview, especially when he talked about when he saw Ronaldo for the first time.
Yeah, there's two things that really stood out to me that I think are really interesting for Juventus fans. The first is when he met Cristiano Ronaldo for the first time, that he was like, I've played with this guy on video games. I used to use him all the time in a virtual setting. And all of a sudden you see Ronaldo walking down the hallway and his first thought was like, okay, be cool. And that's maybe something we don't normally think of, right? Because we kind of group all the players as professionals, but there are different levels to this as well. And it is normal that you would get a bit starstruck seeing Ronaldo. And obviously that wears off the second that you guys go in training together and you realize that he's one of the guys. But Weston did say that it's a very close-knit group behind the scenes, that they're all looking out for one another. And he also said that his role has been simplified, that at Schalke, where he was before, he was asked to do a lot more. And maybe that's a product because the team didn't have as much quality, so some of the players had more responsibility. But that at Juventus, under Andrea Pirlo, he has one role, and he has to do that role, and he has a very specific task in the midfield, which is to keep things simple. And it seems like that should be helping him out as well, where he doesn't have to overcomplicate things.
Yeah, as long as he's not backed up by another box-to-box midfielder, I'd like him to be next to somebody who understands how to take possession of the ball. So I think in a packed midfield, he would really grow, because then he could do his task and do it to perfection and do so higher up the pitch and be able to deliver those quick, lovely passes going forward. I just hope that when you put him next to box-to-box midfielders who perhaps are also looking to try to infiltrate the box and not necessarily always in the right place from a disciplinary point of view when it comes to tactical positioning, then I think that a lot will be placed on his shoulders, and that's where he's not going to do his best, especially because, what, this is going to be his third performance for Juventus if he doesn't need start for Crotone. I think it's very important to not just throw him in on the deep end like I thought he was against Roma.
Really quickly, Mina, we're talking about the midfield, and you suggested a midfield three, and it seems like the biggest issue for Pirlo in the first few months will be that he doesn't really have a set starting 11. I don't think he has a set formation yet, because he said he can go from a four to a three. We've seen just a three so far. But I'm wondering, when Paulo Dybala is coming back and he's playing, I expect him to be in the starting 11, the last season's Serie A MVP. Obviously, Cristiano Ronaldo is there. You really don't have room for all of these players. And someone like Federico Chiesa, who's coming in, who needs to play to continue growing. The reason why he's gotten better now at Fiorentina is because he's starting almost every single game. He has more than 32 starts, I think, in the last few seasons. And he's not going to get that at Juventus. He just isn't, unless you want to go with a team that looks like a video game team where you have Kulusevski and Chiesa as the two wingbacks. But to me, that doesn't seem realistic. What about Alexandro then? What about actual players that know how to defend in that position? And it would be too unbalanced. So I'm just worried about Chiesa. And really quickly, I want to know if this is a worry for you, ending up like Bernardeschi, where he's on the fringes, where he's a rotational player, where he doesn't have time to really grow as a player, because he still has areas in his game that he needs to improve.
Yeah, I agree with that. This is why there was a part of me that was like, I'm not sure if you want to bring in all these wingers, that there was it was necessary to bring in a number nine. This is the thing. I would play with three at the back if he really insists on three. I would always prefer four. And then have a midfield of four, and I wanted a diamond. So, like, Arturo Bentancur and Weston McKennie, for example. And at the top of that diamond, I would love Dybala. I wanted it to be a Dzeko Dybala type of, you know, switching back and forth. Now it could be a Morata Dybala if they like, but Morata's obviously not as good doing that. And then have the two guys on the wings, whether that's Kulusevski and Ronaldo, obviously, or Kulusevski and Chiesa. With Bernardeschi, I think the problem is also that he's a versatile player. He's been played in so many different positions. We've seen him as a false number nine under Roberto Mancini, as a winger, as a midfielder, as pretty much everything, even as a fullback. So this is the problem. It's when a guy is trying to develop and moving from somewhere like Fiorentina to the pressure cooker that is Juventus, asking him to always just fill in auxiliary roles, whatever's available on the pitch. It's very hard for you to hone your skill. Chiesa, I hope, will be played always in one position, whether that's often or not. I think there are enough games to satisfy him and Kulusevski in that position. I just hope that they don't do what Fiorentina did, which is play him as a wing back, you know, get him to utilize different roles because he's just so talented. No, don't do that. Let's perfect the player first. Let's take our time, which is why I used to like the way that Allegri took his time introducing players, because then they felt comfortable. But Dybala is a must at the moment. But again, if you have Dybala, is there a need for Ramsey?
Mina, before we do move on from talking about Juventus, the bastion of journalism that is El Chiringuito in Spain, put out the rumor that Sergio Ramos could be on his way to Juve at some point. Apparently Ronaldo's had a word with him. But you know a bit more about this, that maybe this could be a possibility in the future.
I know Fabio Paratici is a big fan. I know half of Italy is a big fan of Sergio Ramos, to be honest. It's difficult not to be just because he is so good. But he is turning 35 in March. So, and it's really funny, when the news came out, Nicky Bandini sent me a text message saying, are these guys trying to create the footballing version of Las Vegas, which is a bunch of old guys trying to have one last hurrah? And it does seem that if you introduce Ramos to Bonucci and Chiellini, it's like, how old is this backline? But if in any way, shape or form, they actually sort of distract from the growing, the necessary development of players like Demiral and De Ligt to bring in Ramos, then I will be furious. But I will always be a huge fan, like Stevie Nicol, of Sergio Ramos.
So what do you say, Nicky? You up for it? An old Real Madrid boys club at Juventus?
I mean, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea for them as a team. Am I thinking it could be entertaining for me to watch? I was going to call back to the movie Las Vegas, but actually I never saw it, so I can't say if that was an entertaining movie to watch. But I just remember the trailer. It didn't look like a movie I would enjoy, but I'm sure some people did. Maybe it would make the title race more interesting, because I don't think it would make Juventus better, so put it that way.
He's not a starter. Sergio Ramos is not a starter on this Juventus side. No. Chiellini's a better pure defender, even though he's injured all the time, which is a shame. You need Bonucci there for his distribution, which Pirlo's been utilizing a ton. And then the third spot, you've got a guy by the certain name of Matthijs de Ligt, who's the future best defender in the world. And oh, by the way, Demiral as a backup, who's also one of our favorite center backs in the league. So you bring in a Sergio Ramos that's entering his twilight. He's probably already been there, has scored some great goals. I understand that there's a lot of people who love him, and rightfully so. But he's not getting into this team. He's not starting in that back three.
No.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm telling you one thing, though. Okay, I'm a huge fan of Sergio Ramos. I would take him over Chiellini. I know that's mad. I would take him over Bonucci as well. If you have Sergio Ramos and Chiellini at the back, or just two, like, you know, this is a player that allows you to be offensive. If Manchester City had Sergio Ramos, who's so good at one-on-one, if they do lose the ball, at least you know you have a leader at the back, rather than all these guys that are so overwhelmed because all they know how to do is pass the ball and nothing more.
If you put Sergio Ramos and Bonucci in the same defense, what you're going to get is a lot of red cards. Some will be for you and some will be for the other team.
Sergio Ramos's dream was always to play up front, and Ancelotti did promise him, you know, one game I'll do it, and it didn't come to that. Maybe he's thinking of playing further forward if he comes to Juventus. Who knows? Maybe he'll do the Jacko role, the target man.
This is so based on the Instagram post in which they said there's more to come from us, and everyone's right into it.
Yeah, let's move on to the big game this weekend then. It's the Derby della Madonnina, or is it, Nicky? Do we think this is going ahead? And even if it does go ahead, there's a big asterisk next to this one, especially with Inter missing the players that they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll go ahead. It was telling that Pepe Marotta left a league meeting just yesterday and was asked, is this game going ahead? And just basically said no comment and walked off. So there's certainly some sort of, there's certainly going to be some sort of anxiety around it until it happens. At the moment, it looks like Inter are going to meet the requirements set originally by UEFA and adopted by the Italian Football Federation of having at least 13 players, including a goalkeeper. So the game should go ahead. I know that just before the break, we had that story with Napoli and people are going to look at that. The difference there is that was the Naples local authority telling them they could not travel. And this game is happening in Milan. So there's no way for Inter to travel. And as far as we know, the authorities in Milan are happy for the game to go ahead. So it should go ahead. It certainly, if it does go ahead, is going to be a game that presents some pretty tricky conundrums for Antonio Conte, because as you've just alluded to, missing a heap of players. I don't actually have the full list in front of me, but the first two names that come straight into my head are Skriniar and Bastoni at the back, because yeah. Immediately you're looking at a back three that's, well, I mean, actually it's the same back three, a better back three actually slightly than you started with against Fiorentina, because you've got De Vrij in the middle of it with D'Ambrosio on one side and then Kolarov at the other side. The problem is against Fiorentina with De Vrij swapped out for Bastoni, it didn't look like a good back three at all. It was a total mess. And yes, De Vrij is a sort of a much better choice to have in the middle. He's got more experience there. He is sort of the guy who can pull things together. And the problem with Bastoni, who I really like as a player and who's developing into something really promising, is he shouldn't really be in the middle of it when you've got on one side a guy who's really spent most of his career at wing back, even though he played a few games in a back three at Roma, and you've got a guy in D'Ambrosio who, yeah, played this role a bit last season but hasn't played it a lot. There was a lot of inexperience in that group. At least with De Vrij, you have some leadership and someone who can say, oh, you get there, you do that. But it's not. Yeah. It's not good. It's not what you want going into derby at all.
Yeah, and thankfully De Vrij is there because he's been Inter's best defender, but he's flanked by two fullbacks. One of them, yeah. Kolarov, has already made a few absolute howlers at the back. But I think this is where you see a bit of the depth for Inter, because even in the midfield right now, the expected lineup, Brozovic, Vidal, Barella as the three central midfielders, that's a very strong unit. Hakimi is the right wing back, Perisic on the other side, and of course Lautaro and Lukaku up front. So it's still a starting 11, despite, I think, all the COVID tests that equaled six in the end for Inter. Mm-hmm. It's still a very strong side and one that is still favored to win this derby, and those front two will cause plenty of problems to a Milan side that is having some defensive problems of their own, even with Alessio Romagnoli supposedly coming back after a pretty lengthy layover through injury. I think Inter still has enough to get by. We'll get a little bit more into that, but it's still a strong 11 despite all the COVID tests.
But there is hope that Bastoni will be available, because the quarantine period in Italy has been moved from 14 to 10 days. So hopefully there is a chance that he can actually feature in that match. But it does worry me if you are going to start with sort of Kolarov and then Perisic on that side. It's, you know, this is the problem with Fiorentina. They did concede a lot of goals against a team that knows how to possess the ball. Now, what you have with Milan is, obviously, we know that they're good in the fullback positions. We know that Theo Hernandez can do something special. But what you can do, what you also have with Milan, is that they're very good through the middle as well. You've got Frank Kessie, Benacer, Çalhanoğlu, lots of creativity. So if you cancel out all the play on the wings, and if you just go on who's going to win through the middle, then I would say that Milan is better equipped on a flexible level tactically to win this match. So it remains to be seen whether Inter will use their physical ability, their robustness, that power to press, win back possession. They do have players like you mentioned, Vidal and Barella, who are so good as well in that midfield. But I think from a team that understands how to keep possession, perhaps in a midfield that is very, very good at Milan, I'm interested to see how this is going to go out from a tactical point of view and whether Pioli will win.
So if Mina's edging towards Milan there, what do you two think? Because it sounded to me, Matteo, that you were going towards Inter with this one.
I am going with Inter just slightly, even though Ibrahimovic is back for Milan. I expect him to get almost man-marked by Steven De Vrij, because if Ibra is against any one of the two fullbacks, he's going to dominate that. He's going to be able to hold up play. So at least De Vrij is there to try to nullify Ibrahimovic just a little bit. But I still think that based on what we've seen in recent form, and I know that this Milan side has now gone on an unbelievable run. They haven't lost a game in Serie A since post-lockdown, but against Inter, that's where they seem to always struggle in recent times. Exactly, their biggest test yet. Although I was getting a little bit annoyed with everyone bringing up, oh, Matteo, you're mentioning Milan's perfect start. Look at who they've played. Have you guys not watched Milan in the last 10 years and all the games that they've dropped against teams they should be beating? You don't get into the top four because you beat Juventus and Inter. You can drop those 6 points against Juve and against Inter as long as you beat the teams you should be beating. And they weren't getting the job done against the mid-table sides, against the teams at the bottom of the table fighting for salvation. So you get those 3 points where you're favored. And then it's fine to drop points against Inter. Top four is the primary objective. Inter and Milan have very different objectives. Inter's the anti-Juve. Milan's desperately trying to get back into the top four. And I still have Inter as a slight favorite in the derby.
Nikki?
I mean, just off the top, just to pull back to something Matteo said a second ago, Milan's defense not looking that good. Milan's defense doesn't look good on paper. I mean, last game, I think it was Simon Kjær and Gabbia starting a center back. This game, maybe we'll see Romagnoli back there. But the fact is, they haven't conceded a goal yet. Like, whatever you want to say about how they look, actually,
against
they
Galabinov,
conceded.
Though. But that's the thing, is Lautaro Lukaku coming in posed a very different challenge. And
it's incredibly
difficult to stop those two.
Right. And that's the big question for me, because I want to disagree with Mina on principle, because it's the first time this season we've been on opposite each other on the podcast. But actually, I agree that the middle of the park is Milan's. I think that Benassi and Kessié should dominate there. And I think the big, big question mark is, can Lautaro and Lukaku, who are both in form, both scored in the international games, can they just carry that on? Because I do have concerns for Inter. I have concerns at the back, which I've already talked about. I think that when we look at the sheer number of players they got absent, there's a chance that they won't even have five substitutes. And when you look, Conte has been using his five substitutes to change games. So can Conte change a game if he doesn't have all of those options off the bench? Also, you know, Conte has done lots of things right, but this team, to me, still looks like it is so effective when it is given space to play into. But if Milan are smarter about it, if Milan occupy those spaces in the trequarti, the space in front of their own defence, you know, behind the midfield, if they occupy that well, we're still waiting for Christian Eriksen to prove that he can be something and change that space. We're still waiting for Inter to show that they've got another solution in that space. Because for now, for me, I'm not sold on it. So,
but I really don't know
with this game. I really don't.
I agree with you. I think that actually, weirdly enough, I'd start Alexis Sanchez rather than Lautaro Martinez or Lukaku. I just think that he's better when it comes to his movement at the top, and he might create a little bit more. But one of the reasons why I think as well, like you said, you know, that when it is the center of the park, Milan win it, which is why I think they're defensively strong, because they provide so much coverage. So that's where I'm interested to see. Mm. And this is huge for Conte, because he always gets accused of losing to you know, sort of the big players in the league. And even though, despite the fact that Inter have won pretty much every single derby since, 2016, so this is going to be interesting, because if he loses to Milan, we're going to say the same things again. Oh, Conte can't do it.
Did I hear that right? Did I hear that right? That Mina said she wants the bench Lautaro for Alexis Sanchez. I didn't.
I know that sounds crazy, but I think that I would bench Lukaku. Maybe.
He won't do that, though, will he?
You can't bench Lautaro and Lukaku. So. Those are the first two names on the team sheet.
No, you can't.
Yeah, but I think at this point in time, when you don't have Eriksen playing and you don't have enough creativity in midfield, because
play
you're relying
three.
On
play,
your wing.
Play Sanchez, play 3-4-3, play Alexis Sanchez, Lautaro and Lukaku all together.
You could absolutely, with the way he's lining up, which is basically a 3-5-2, of course, it's fluid, everything is nowadays, but you could definitely have a figure in the middle of that who's Alexis Sanchez type, if you chose to. I agree with Mina that Alexis is playing well. I disagree completely that you can drop Lautaro or Lukaku, because they're crucial and they're such in form as well at the moment. I think you certainly have options if you're Conte, which is surprising given how many players are absent, but you have them in one specific area of the pitch, which is that you have options up front and just behind the attack. Further back, you're pretty much hands tied. You've got to use the obvious starting defence, and you've got to use pretty much five of six players from left to right across midfield. So it's going to be a fascinating game, and I'm going to be, since we've got one pick for Milan and one for Inter, I'm going to be the fence sitter and say it's going to be a draw.
I knew there would be one draw.
Always on the fence.
So now the argument's between me and Matteo. Nikki, there's no point to us being on at the same time.
Okay, well, we'll find out if it does go ahead. It does look as though everything is going to go ahead with the Milan derby, and of course we'll be talking about it next week. Napoli, Atalanta, woof. Napoli came through their isolation. They've started well. It's 2 wins from 2, no goals conceded, 8 scored. Atalanta have 3 wins from 3, 13 goals scored. Nikki, what are we expecting in this clash?
Fireworks, I hope. I don't know what else to expect. It's, you know, all of the games this weekend, I think, are going to be a little bit more complicated because we are coming back quick from this international break, and especially this game starting at lunchtime on Saturday, there's not much time for players who've been away to reintegrate quickly. But Atalanta are flying. They've started the season as well as they possibly could. Napoli have had this slightly even more complicated preparation where a lot of players have been in the COVID bubble at the team training centre. But again, the two games we've had from them, absolutely ridiculous football going on up front. We talked about Osimhen. I raved about Osimhen on this podcast the other week, so I don't need to tell everyone all about that all over again. But certainly, just so many attacking options on the pitch. Two teams that are committed to playing a certain way. Atalanta, again, have talked about it a lot on the podcast, the fact that they play this essentially one-on-one brand of football where you just trust your players to beat their man constantly. And that's a great recipe for them. It's a recipe that's worked for them, but you do it against a team like Napoli that has Mertens, that has Lozano in this sort of form, that has Osimhen coming in and playing as he does. You leave options. You leave the chance to get hit back on the counter-attack. And I don't see that Atalanta playing the other way, and I don't see Napoli suddenly reinventing themselves for this game. There's certainly been a suggestion that Gattuso might give Bakayoko his first game for Napoli, which would be interesting to see what he adds in midfield. But in terms of style, we know who these teams are. We know that they're fun to watch, and so it would be a surprise to me if we don't get a good game between them on Saturday.
I think the best news for Napoli is that Victor Osimhen hasn't scored yet, and they've won, and he's been brilliant without scoring a goal, and he's the striker that they paid, I think, around $90 million for all in all. So that is great news. He's expected to lead the line again, but this Atalanta side, it felt like they've been playing a different sport altogether than everyone else in Serie A. I mean, they've put in some performances that leave me absolutely speechless. We've had the pleasure of commentating their games this season on ESPN, and you come away from those games thinking, this is a different sport than most of the games I've watched. And I'm glad that you mentioned the international break, because with this success, it's meant that a lot of the players for Atalanta that are starters have also gotten call-ups. Remo Freuler for Switzerland, who scored a brilliant goal, I think, against Germany. Beautiful chip. Robin Gosens is now seemingly a mainstay on the German national team. Hans Heidebohr has gotten a call-up from his country as well. So this is an actual problem now for Atalanta. Mm. But the good news is they have depth, and this is what the Champions League money does. It allows Percassi to invest in this club. They're not a selling club really anymore. They are in the terms of being shrewd about it by selling players that weren't even really on the team, like Kulusevski and Traoré, but they haven't lost anyone who's really important to their starting 11, and they have the depth suddenly to replace those players when one of them is injured or maybe test positive for COVID. I still think that Atalanta are the favorites just because of the kind of football that they've been playing. I think the Napoli game against Genoa was a bit of an outlier, especially looking back and what happened with the Genoa squad, that almost the entire starting 11 had COVID, and maybe they had COVID, maybe they were showing symptoms during the game. But
Nikki mentioned,
yeah, exactly. So we don't even know how that could have possibly affected them. But suddenly you look at that result and it just seems a bit more strange, and it's hard to take anything from that. But right now, Atalanta, I've gone as far as saying that they're maybe the anti-Juve, that they could challenge for the Scudetto.
You're not allowed to say that. The president
said... I don't care. Of course he's going to say that.
The president has said he is not having your anti-Juve pick. He just said it this week, not personally to us on Serie A, although we have
been a bit...
He called
up after listening.
You know, we've been very trigger-happy with the old anti-Juve picks, haven't we? But he's very, very happy to not have Atalanta in that conversation. You can understand why.
Yeah, of course. I mean, again... he's going to say that, and I disagree with him. I think what's interesting actually is that even though he does say that, one of the sort of shifts that I think you witnessed in this Atalanta team last season was that switch in mindset from being an underdog to not really behaving like an underdog anymore. I think you've seen it in the games they've played so far this season. In Italy, we would talk about, squadre provinciali, which literally means provincial and shouldn't really apply to a team like Atalanta because, look, they're from an industrial city. It's not a big city, but it's still, an economically successful city in the north. It's not a small provincial town, but that's how we talk about them in sort of footballing terms. They were a provincial club. They weren't one of the big teams, the Sette Sorelle, the teams that are supposed to win things. But they've started behaving like it. They've started treating sort of games against lesser clubs like games where you expect to flatten an opponent. And then they come into the games against a team like Napoli thinking, yeah, we can beat Napoli. We can play Napoli and we don't have to alter who we are or how we play our game at all to take on these games, or indeed PSG in the Champions League, even though they didn't in the end get the result. They still played it their way. So I think that, it doesn't surprise me that Pep Cassi, and it's reasonable and realistic to say, look, we don't have the resources that Juventus do, but the way they play, they're not a provincial club anymore. They're a club that's playing to finish at least in the top four.
Yeah, that's really interesting what you said about them actually having this winning mentality, because I remember the first season when Gasperini came to Atalanta that they would still be a bit of an inconsistent side. They would pick up a win against a very big team at home and you think, well, it's the 12th man, it's that brilliant crowd that they have there in Bergamo, and then they'd go and they squander points against teams that they should easily be beating. I think the consistency is what you've seen more importantly from them, and suddenly the belief that, hold on a second, we can put three or four past Juve, we can put three past Inter, we can beat these teams. And they've been doing it now repeatedly for three seasons consistently, and also going further than any Italian team in the Champions League. But it seems like what Atalanta have done is they save their best performances for the best opponents. They really play up to their opposition. We've seen some of the most memorable games for Atalanta be against Juventus, against Inter especially, and teams like Napoli, teams that are competing for one of those top four spots. So it is, I feel like we've all gotten used to now Atalanta being a top four contender, where 10 years ago, a team that bounced between Serie A and Serie B, this would have been crazy talk.
Yeah, absolutely. And to get into the meat of the game, I do think that Bakayoko pick could be really, really interesting, because we talked about it a lot last week, Papu Gomez and the freedom he has to roam. I think you need to put some sort of resistance to that. And Bakayoko, he's bounced around a bit the last few years. We haven't seen him at his best, but certainly what he can be is this extremely rangy, extremely sort of all over the pitch player that can contribute everywhere. And I almost wonder if a presence like that could be a good antidote to your Papu Gomez, to be someone who can move around with him and make sure he doesn't find those spaces.
Yeah, Bakayoko played, ironically, his best football in Serie A with Milan, and it looked like he was going to go back to Milan, but with Franceschi, they didn't really need him. I think he'll do the role of Alan, right? That the ball winner, the guy who can chase people down, because if there's anything that Napoli maybe are missing now, it is that replacement for Alan, and Bakayoko fits the bill, I think, a bit better than all the other midfielders that they have right now on their squad.
And potentially fresh, because he hasn't been used yet. You have got all these players coming back from everywhere, so it's a thought. And then maybe he won't even be in the team now, and I'll be a wasted thought, but I think it's an interesting idea, certainly.
I wonder if you both saw, if we go to Napoli, that Arik Milik is not happy right now. He wanted to move away. Napoli put the stoppers on that one. He said he's just going to ride it out. But that's taken quite the nosedive from how it started for him at Napoli to this situation.
Yeah, I don't know if Napoli so much put the stoppers on it as, De Laurentiis wanted his price. And as we sort of talked about, again, there was this sort of set of dominoes almost waiting to happen, where Edin Dzeko was supposed to head off to Juventus and then Milik would go to Roma and everyone would be happy. And when the Juventus domino didn't fall, everyone was left kind of unhappy at the end of it. He's certainly been marginalised by the arrival of Osimhen. It's the reason why I don't believe for a second that De Laurentiis wanted him to still be there, because De Laurentiis doesn't want to have that loss on the books. He wants to make the money back for it. But he's had a frustrating time. When he first got to Naples, he was really looked like something very promising, something different, something that could give an alternative to that quick and small, the Smurfs up front approach, give you a big target man. He does feel suddenly, looking at Osimhen, and I know I'm going to get too far along on this Osimhen bandwagon, he'll disappoint me, but he just looks, He looks anomalous. He looks like a different brand of football altogether, whereas you've got someone in Osimhen who has the physical characteristics that you wanted to, but that actually marries together with the kind of football that you're trying to play. And so I don't think Milik is a busted flush as a footballer at all. I think he's had some injuries that have set him back, but I think in the right system, he could be very effective. It's a shame it hasn't worked for him in Naples.
Yeah, and I agree that Osimhen is a player that I think has this added dynamism, and he has that ability where we think, right, he can be a world-class striker. He'd be one of the best. But Fradek Milik, multiple catastrophic ligament injuries, those are difficult to come back. Those change the course of a footballer's career. But when he was healthy, he showed he can be someone in Serie A that got you 16 to 18 goals and a very solid Serie A striker. And I feel a bit for him because he could have been leading the line right now for Roma.
We've all got our safety belts on for the Victor Osimhen bandwagon. Don't worry. We're not alone on that one. And let's see how long we keep them strapped. We've got to wrap it up there. And just to finish it though, Matteo, just to let us know what games you're on this weekend, because I think you've got a packed schedule on ESPN.
Yeah, we do. So we're actually commentating the Derby della Madonnina on ESPN Plus, assuming that it goes ahead. And then we've got the Roma game late Sunday afternoon. So it should be a great weekend. It's unfortunate that, you know, COVID has become such a problem so far early on in the season. And it'll be really interesting to see the developments in the next few days with COVID, with Serie A, with some of the teams that are playing. I mean, just look at Genoa that are basically have to field a youth team squad because most of the team has tested positive.
Yeah, we will be back though next week to talk more Serie A with you and to look back on what is a packed weekend of action. But for now, that's it from us. Ciao for now.